Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Larkin, Judge Smith, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals Zoom arguments. Our first case this morning, I hope I pronounced this correctly, is Burjerke, or, well, someone will tell me, versus Commissioner of Public Safety, and also the companion criminal case. The file number is 821-1109, 821-1425. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. As you are also aware, we are recording this, but our rules prohibit anyone either observing or participating from making their own private recording, so please keep that in mind. With that, counsel for the appellant, you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. This is Attorney Jacob Burkholz. I believe it's Mr. Burjerke. And he is the defendant and petitioner in this combined consolidated appeal. And this was a stipulated fact trial that came as a result of a combined contested implied consent case where Mr. Burjerke challenged the constitutionality of the right-hand turn lane statute, as well as the basis for his stop. As a practical matter, I would agree that we have waived any argument on the expansion argument on appeal, so that's non-issue. I mean, so we're going to lose anyway. So the only one here is whether or not...
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah, I think I win on the other ones. But the...
Well, we'll certainly let you know.
Yeah, that's right. The point, I like to think I'm going to tackle the easy one first here, which is this kind of notion that there was an alternative basis for the stop at the stop sign. I don't believe so. The district court, I read that order carefully and does not make any findings. He makes a recitation in the record as to the testimony of Deputy Arkell, but there's no findings or basis for the stop by the district court, which I believe would mean that there is no finding that there was a valid stop based on this alleged stop at the stop sign. So I know that was kind of very limitedly argued. The attorney general also makes a responsive argument, which I don't believe. You know, the district court's order is, I don't know, a bit lackluster in its overall breadth and understanding. But the argument is that there's some sort of totality.
You know, I don't think I would say that too often.
Judge Anderson?
Well, to a panel that has two prior district court judges on it.
Oh, yes. Well, I didn't bring motions for amended findings, but we'll leave that as that. But where we have it is, you know, there's a lack of a clarity, I think, as to what's the underlying reason by the district court on the totality argument. There's kind of an illusion under Timberlake. I only can say that with true jest with Judge Anderson. And in the past, I think I appealed him on Timberlake, which he affirmed in Tomlinson on several other cases. But I like Judge Anderson and his clerk, Rebecca, which wrote this. But nonetheless, you know, the attorney general seems to make the preliminary argument that there's a basis in totality to make a larger argument under the Fourth Amendment that even if there's no identifiable basis in law, that their stop is valid.
Well, what about, counsel, what about these facts? And I understand, you know, you and the attorney general have a different view about what as close as practical means. But, mm-hmm. you know, the facts are we have a squad car video showing two of these turns. We have a squad car video showing the vehicle drifting into its lane. You know, this is 2 a.m. at closing time. He's leaving downtown with bars and the officer's training and experience. Why isn't that enough all kind of together, apart from, you know, what we all think of the words as close as practicable? So what's your response to that, sir?
Yeah, maybe it's taking me too long to get there. That's where I disagree. And so Morse, you know, the kind of argument by the Supreme Court that kind of threw out the appellate court order and said, there's enough facts generally. I think they cited five facts, as Your Honor kind of mentioned, in the Supreme Court overturning the appellate ruling, which is, number one, there was no weaving, no drifting, in my view, no swerving, no unusual behavior. We do have a general concept that downtown Mankato is the bar scene. I would disagree with that generally down by Walnut Street. You never saw him come by. You know, actually, the number four restaurant, which I used to have my office above that restaurant at that turn, The bar is way, there's several. One way back around in the corner, there's no identifiable basis that he saw him coming from a bar. And this kind of also argument by Deputy Arkell, which, you know, I don't, this training and experience, he doesn't, I personally think, I've had him reversed about a half a dozen times based on his quote unquote training and experience. But I like Deputy Arkell, nice guy. And he admits when he
takes I'm sure he and the district court like you too.
So yeah, right.
We'll make sure that's in the opinion.
And see, he turns and he admits he went over the center line on that turn. Because I said, if you look at the video, this whole kind of concept that he's engaging in this odd behavior. And if you see my cross-examine later in the transcript, Deputy Arkell says, well, actually, I tried to pull him over because I believed he was impaired. And then I said to him, well, what evidence do you have of impairment? And he says, none. And then he goes on to say, well, actually, he had a medical issue. And I said, well, how in the world do you know there's a medical issue? So this concept of training and experience that he says, well, when people make right-hand turns, they're engaged in medical problems. That's actually what he said in the transcript. So this kind of concept that there's training and experience, that was not elaborated by the attorney general or the district court. And this general concept that, well, all people that turn right-hand downtown at a certain time of the day are impaired, I think is contrary to the record in the transcript. And there's nothing to elaborate in that. And I don't think the district court or the video supports the kind of common argument of drifting. I also look back at the district court order and the underlying file in Morse, and this kind of argument by the dissent, which seems to say that this turn, which had a undefined center line, which is a bit different than this case, went all the way across the road to hit almost a parked car. And that was the dissent in Morse. So I certainly don't think there's a basis in this case to kind of dodge the question on the validity of the statute and simply say, well, it's close enough. I understand that the court could attempt to do that, and that's the easiest out for the attorney general. So respectfully, I disagree. And so I think the statute can't be saved. This as close as practical just leaves law enforcement as to make whatever determination it wants. And that's really what happens. There's no language in the statute to save it. The court can't define it without legislative action by the judiciary, which is improper, by coming up with some additional language. That's probably the interesting irony of my argument, which is, do we add a danger element? You know, the added danger element might conceptually save it by some other jurisdictional arguments. I'm not sure this court can actually do that, but we put it in there because it probably could. And if it did, by narrowly construing the statute, because of course, the courts want to possibly save statutes from their constitutionality flaws. But as a practical matter, I don't think the attorney general really makes any clear argument that it can be saved. And nor can it be as close as practical. Actually, the district court cited Parker v. Levy, which I couldn't even find that quote in the case, honestly. I read the whole thing and it seemed to talk about military personnel and was completely on point. It had to do with, you know, codifying military statutes on conduct, but so I didn't understand that pulled by the district court. Any rate, what we have is as close as practical means whatever the officer wants it to be. Well, if you listen, you know, what they do in the troopers and the officers, they make comments on their squad video. Well, you went over the center line or it's too wide. Well, what is that? But then it becomes too close to the curb, or then it becomes, well, whatever it wants the officer to be. And of course, we have this conversation about trailers and do you have a trailer? I just wanted something in the record because Mr. Bierke runs Western Specialized. He's actually a truck driver manager and had him testify because I think this is kind of, we needed something in the record to show why are you taking wide right-hand turns? Because there really isn't a dispute that I think the second turn is fairly wide. I reviewed it a few times on the video, but it's not as wide as the original Morse, which was actually reversed. Because he doesn't go all the way across with his vehicle, but there's no safety concerns, no oncoming traffic. And you see, and undisputedly, two people cross the crosswalk almost simultaneously from him making the turn. We talk about that at the district court transcript level and say, well, Deputy Arkell said, well, I just would have waited a little bit longer and then I would have made a tighter right-hand turn. If you look carefully, there's actually side parking on that right-hand turn as well. While there might not be a giant bus parked there at the moment, the concept this year is, can a person safely take a turn which could conceptually touch the center line? And the answer is, well, of course, commercial driving and the DMV make it mandatory. And in fact, they train it, and we put that citation in the CDL. So what if you have a trailer? What if you had a big vehicle? And so I don't think the statute can be saved by simply saying, well, he had a Chrysler 300. That thing's a boat. I mean, it's a big vehicle, and he's trying to take it. And if you look at the first turn, I don't even think it was wide. If you look at it closely on his tires, although it's stated it's wide. The second one, I think, undisputedly is wide. You can see his tire. I think as a finding, you could say the tire went over maybe a tire width over the center line, front and back. Is that wide enough then to simply say, well, it's good enough for the stop? And I suppose if I didn't challenge the constitutionality, yes, I would lose this argument. But the statute and the behavior can't be saved when you read, even if you were to attempt to argue that, well, you know, the officer had some sort of basis because he could have driven closer to the right-hand shoulder than he otherwise could. So then the interpretation becomes, well, what is close as practical under the circumstances? And I think Arkell says on the first turn, well, I couldn't turn any closer than Bierke did, and I went over the center line. So is the second turn onto Cherry Street just a little bit wider? And then conceptually, he might have been able to make the turn without touching the center line. Well, keep in mind, the people that went across the street actually came before the deputy Arkell entered the intersection. And that was testified to by Mr. Bierke at the trial, that there's people coming, and twofold reasons. One, for the safety of the individuals that crossed at night. Keep in mind, your vision when you're that old, it probably isn't as good. And you have people coming with these lights. There's multiple people. He's a truck driver by nature. We can't just destroy his entire habit, which is to make safe, right, wide turns according to the commercial driving code. And then all of a sudden say, well, you know what? All commercial truck drivers that make wide right-hand turns that have big trucks and trailers, which at this time of the year, I probably see that violation 20 times a day when I drive, because there's commercial trucks, big trucks, F-350s, dualies, trailers. It's summer and spring in Minnesota. It's called construction season. Every single one of these people would be pulled over and have no argument whatsoever for DUI at any time of the day or night for any reason whatsoever. And if someone could simply say, well, you weren't as close as practical. If you look at a Morse case underlying it, it's no clarity. It actually had a fog line either, which shows why the right-hand turn lane statute makes no distinction whether they're center lines or fog lines or any lines, because the officer can arbitrarily enforce it. So reading the two cases together, how does the officer say you were as close as practical? Well, he doesn't, because then it revolves around the district court simply reviewing squad videos at night saying, I don't think that was as close. I think I have a couple more of these pending. And I'll have to have this argument again where an officer sees an individual multiple blocks away at night. That's almost all of these videos for DWI stops. They're at night and they see an intersection. And when they see the intersection, they're going to say, well, it was too wide. How do you know if the tires went over? It won't matter. And that's the irony of this case, is the way it's been interpreted is it won't matter whatsoever if you touch the fog line or center line. And I can appreciate, you know, the argument here is that I lost the Susie case, which got denied to the Supreme Court, which is, well, now the interpretation of the, you know, being within one's lane, which is the other argument, not in this case particularly, but to kind of somehow try to interpret the two statutes together, creates a per se violation by Judge Ross. I actually thought Court of Appeals argument went really well there. But nonetheless, I thought I was going to get reversed.
I did have one question, and I just want to make sure I understand the record, counsel. So is it, he did go over, I mean, do you dispute that the vehicle crossed over the center lane divider both times?
Yes, on the first one.
Okay, so you dispute the first one, but not the second one.
Yeah, I mean, the video is pretty good.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's actually the same argument we had in Susie, which was we spent the entire argument about whether or not there was a lane violation prior to the video. You know, it makes a footnote in our arguments. But nonetheless, you know, the argument then becomes, well, so that's about the only part of the argument I won in Susie, which is, well, you're right, but we'll uphold the stop based on a, you know, this kind of tennis basketball argument, right? Which is the line in the line or is the line out of the line? But here we don't have a line issue. So I think it's not really a determining factor, nor should it be in your opinion, because there's no requirement that the statute that was allegedly violated was the statute that actually involves Susie or is practical in one's lane. It solely involves one issue. Do you turn right close enough or not? And whether...
Excuse me, Council. Can I ask a question relative to the pedestrians? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what how they factor in. I assume, what's your argument about them? That they were in the street when you made the turn, in the crosswalk when you made the turn?
Immediately thereabouts.
So they were in a crosswalk and you made a turn?
No.
Okay, that's what I didn't understand.
Yeah, so I pulled the video up. That's a nice part of Zoom. But I mean, you can see them. They hit the crosswalk, the safe area. There's no allegation that he went while they were in the crosswalk.
Okay, that's what I wanted to understand.
Yeah, no. There's
they were people. On the sidewalk.
Yes, they were there, but I think he testified that they were just coming onto the sidewalk when he makes a turn. So to make sure that they weren't standing at the curb, right? He's like, I'm just going to be safe. Make a wide turn for the pedestrians to be safe, which they were, which the court didn't dispute, nor do I think the attorney general disputes. It just goes to the reasonableness.
At night, if people have gone to a bar and they're walking, they never make unexpected moves, right? I mean, that just never happens. People are always paying close attention to the crosswalk dividers, pausing, looking both ways, both eyes on the road. That wow.
That's two blocks.
I'm just so impressed with the citizenry of Mankato at night.
I see I'm out of time unless anyone has any additional questions.
Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Corey Marsalek. I represent the respondent, Commissioner of Public Safety. We request that this court affirm the district court's order suppressing the evidence in the omnibus criminal case and sustaining the license revocation in the implied consent. I'll begin with Judge Conley's question that the outset of the hearing, that the totality of the facts in the record as found by the district court and just in the record generally, support that in total, Pellin's driving conduct supported reasonable articulable suspicion to support the stop. As the district court found, this is an area of Mankato where there are many bars and heavy foot traffic. It was later in the evening, and the deputy, as the district court found, credibly testified that he observed the possibility of three separate traffic violations. First, the stop in the crosswalk. Second, the crossing the center line on his first right turn, and then crossing the center line on the third right turn. The second right turn. And in the second right turn, the deputy testified that he was so concerned by the driving conduct that he looked for the first opportunity to pull the appellant over. As this court is aware, reasonable articulable suspicion is a low hurdle, and this crosses that low hurdle as found by numerous cases of this court. But even without having to reach that issue, the clear violations that the district court of the traffic laws that the district court found support the reasonable articulable suspicion to stop the appellant's vehicle. As I mentioned, you have the apparent stop in the crosswalk, which the district court did find on page 2 of his addendum, that Deputy Arkle credibly testified that he saw the vehicle's front tires stop over the crosswalk and observe that the vehicle was obstructing the crosswalk. That apparent violation supported reasonable articulable suspicion to stop the vehicle. The district court further found that he observed that Deputy Arkle observed the vehicle drive over the lane divider as it made another wide right turn. Antecedent to that, the district court found that the driver's side tires went over the lane divider and into the oncoming lane of traffic. That also supports reasonable articulable suspicion. As our brief articulates, there are at least 4 non-precedential opinions of this court that have concluded that those are violations of 169A19 subdivision 1A. And for that matter, because those are clear violations of 169.19 subdivision 1A, appellant cannot contest the constitutionality of the statute because his conduct is clearly covered by the statute. As the district court found.
I was wondering if you could, apart from what we all think of the words closest practicable, could you perhaps give me an example of where it would not be possible to do it as close as practicable? Like, what would that entail? Where it would not be possible to do it as close as practicable because of, raining. Like there's cones because there's construction. I'm just trying to get a feel for when it would not be, when you couldn't do it as close as practicable.
Well, I think I would, as I understand how Your Honor is using the term practicable, I think that in the context, I understand you to be using it as you seem to be using it as possible. And I don't think that possible is practicable. I think practicable is broader in order to encompass the reasonable surrounding circumstances. So in the case
of... Well, then give me an example of where it would be impracticable.
I think this case is a... is an example of that, where the appellant took a wide right turn over the center line when, as he testified, as the district court found, the only reason he did so is because he always makes those right-hand turns as a when he's driving a truck, but he was not driving a truck, he was driving a four-door sedan. So I think in this case, the turn was not practicable because there
I get why he did it, because, he's used to doing that. But what I'm trying to get a feel of, okay, let's say it's not a DUI. It's just, this is a petty misdemeanor and you're charged with not, I'm trying to find out what's the defense I would have where I could beat, being charged. Well, you didn't drive as close as practicable. And I'm trying to find out, well, could you ever be acquitted? Like, what would be, I couldn't drive as close as practicable because, and I'm trying to find out what would the because be?
I think there are situations where a person could be acquitted because they did drive as close as practicable based on the surrounding circumstances, and their defense would be, here are the circumstances surrounding why I made that right turn. This was as practicable as I could do under those circumstances, and the state charged me erroneously based on that.
And an example would be like, because someone unexpectedly ran in front of the car. And so I had to, turn widely or something. I'm just trying to picture in my mind a factual circumstance that would say, oh yeah, he clearly couldn't do that. That would not have been practicable. So I think Judge Larkin has a question before you answer mine. Go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking about your question and trying to come up with an example. What if right around the turn, there's a huge pothole, one that you see, and it's like, if I hit that, I'm going to lose a tire. So would we argue about whether it's practical to avoid the pothole, to stay in the line, or are you supposed to risk a tire? Is that what you're thinking?
Is that a question for me or Judge Conley?
Well, I know I'd avoid the potholes, so I guess the question is for you. I've avoided the potholes. I'm just going to flat out admit I'm guilty. But, in Minnesota, that's a perfect example. So there's a pothole there. I don't want to wreck my car because, you can never sue the city because they'll always have some immunity. So would that be an example?
I agree. That is a possible example that under the facts and circumstances, if there's a huge pothole right next to the right-hand turn, you turn widely because of that pothole. Again, I'm not here to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was violated the statute, but based on the questions that have been asked, I think that, yes, theoretically, that's a possibility where the circumstances surrounding would show that I had to turn wider because of the pothole or there was construction, or even as Mr. Burkholz identified, that if you're driving a commercial truck and you couldn't, you're required to make a wider turn, which again, appellant was not driving a commercial truck, in those circumstances, you could show that it was practical. And I think that that's why that term is not unconstitutionally vague, because it's in the statute in order to provide for those circumstances. Because if the if the statute did not include the word practicable and you just had to make that right-hand turn, there would be, it would be an arbitrary requirement. There'd be no way to determine whether or not that was the most reasonable way for the person to make that turn. So yes, I think, you know, in Judge Conley's example, if a pedestrian runs out and you're forced to turn wide, or if there's a pothole, as Judge Larkin articulated, or if there's, you're driving a commercial vehicle, there are all sorts of circumstances that would make the turn, a wider turn, reasonable. And I, and for that reason, you know, appellant's contention about the added danger, we'd first, I don't, there's no language in the statute to support including that definition. Second, to the extent that practicable could be construed to include that term, reading the cases that appellant cites, I don't see much of a delta between our position and his position, because those cases all seem to say that you take account of the facts and circumstances surrounding the driving conduct to conclude whether or not the driving conduct was in fact practicable. And also, I know appellant, during appellant's argument, he seemed, at least I interpreted him, to take issue with some of the district court's factual findings on the right-hand turns. In his brief, however, he only takes, except she only challenged the district court's factual findings with respect to the stop sign violation. So I think that any challenge to the district court's findings on the wide right-hand turns are forfeited. And I also know that note that appellant made a number of observations about Deputy Yarkel's testimony and his training and experience, but the district court multiple times articulated that Deputy Yarkel's testimony was credible. That's a factual finding that is afforded deference by this court. Again, just to summarize that the violations that Deputy Yarkel observed that the district court found are clear violations of the statute, as the district court concluded, found that the vehicle in question was a standardized sedan and the vehicle configuration was such that there was no need for appellant to make the turns that he did. Therefore, he clearly violated the statute, and that clear violation of the statute crosses that low hurdle to support reasonable articulable suspicion for the deputy to stop appellant. And it also prohibits the appellant from challenging the constitutionality of the statute because his conduct is clearly covered. And to the extent this court considers the go ahead, Judge Conley.
No, I didn't have a question.
Oh, to the extent this court considers the constitutionality of the statute, we think that the word practicable is understood.
Practicable. Yeah.
Practicable. My apologies.
I think there is a slight definitional difference between the two words. So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page.
Oh, I agree. That's just my verbal error. Practicable. And the word practicable is, takes into account the circumstances surrounding the turn. It's understood by ordinary usage to mean reasonable. As we cite, there's the unpublished case in Rask, where the issue that surrounded the court's making that statement was that the appellants asked for a jury instruction in a negligence case on the right-hand turn statute. There's other errors that the court addressed as well, but relevant to this particular phrase. And the court articulated that it was not error for the court to not instruct on the right-hand turn statute because a right-hand turn is a understood and common knowledge. It's everybody knows how to make a right-hand turn. They make it practically. And for those reasons, if there are no further questions, we would request that this court affirm the district court's order suppressing the evidence in the omnibus case and sustaining the license revocation in the implied consent proceeding.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you very much. Thank you. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you.
I think it's just comes down to not this concept of can people take a right-hand turn, but the compounded subjectivity of law enforcement, which is why the rules of constitutional law cannot save the statute. I mean, I think just hearing the Attorney General's arguments and the arguments of the court on potholes, the statute then would have to have carved out exceptions for construction, potholes, pedestrians, vehicles, birds, other people, distractions, rain, and vehicle configuration, as quoted by the district court. And all of those would be exceptions, which would then have to be read into the statute to save it or to write it in some strange way, because the issue here is the Fourth Amendment's application as a criminal law, not a citation as to standard ordinary principles of negligence, which might apply it very differently. The standard in that must be viewed that whether a reasonable law enforcement officer would not arbitrarily enforce this provision, because this is where I enjoy Deputy Arkell's honesty. And he says, I actually went over the first wide right turn too, because he can't do it at the first corner of Main and Second. You can't. I don't know who wrote those lines, but they're terrible. It's super narrow. I couldn't imagine doing that sober and not touching the inside or the outside line with my front left tire or my back right rear tire, neither of which would save me from a law enforcement stop day or night. And so the question then becomes, okay, so someone paints the lines wide enough, then we're going to get into multiple layers of compounded subjectivity by law enforcement. And I think the Attorney General's comments are an interplay between practical, practicable, reasonable, and need. All of those words were kind of interplayed into this concept. And I think as Black's Law Dictionary and the general definition of practical means the ability to be done or put into practice successfully. Well, Mr. Bierke certainly made the right hand turn successfully and safely. And that, so he was successful in his right hand turn. And Deputy Arkell was successful. And so then what? He gets to say at trial and well, not at trial, but the contested omnibus, I think he has a medical issue because he turned too wide and therefore I think he's DUI and I'm going to pull him over as soon as possible because he didn't need to take the right-hand turn as wide as he did. I mean, this is the real flaw in the statute because every officer will testify to something differently. When there's no lines, that's the same thing they say. It was too close to the front right of his tires. On an entrance to a highway. I think I've had that dismissed twice in Pipestone. They should really line that thing. But the point is that that's what will happen in every on-ramp, every off-ramp. It was too close. It was, well, you were too far. You were too wide. And someone gets to say whatever they want to say to pull someone over. And so these layers of compounded subjectivity, as the court knows, like, well, in Mankato, we have to be extra careful downtown for the citizens and the college kids that are drunk running around the Bermuda Triangle in downtown Mankato in the bar district.
And then I mean, what? Are you saying this was a pretextual stop?
I don't think I can go that far on the record.
Okay.
That wouldn't be fair to Deputy Eric Arkell. But the basis for the stop is important, right? He's not pulling it over because he thinks, well, pretextual in the concept that he's heightened by it being at night downtown. So does that make it pretextual? By him suggesting that any slight possible variation of the law will heighten his sense that the right-hand turn means you're either DUI or you're having a stroke. I mean, that's the danger where this starts to abut against the concept of pretext, where pretext gets to say, well, when does the concept of being at night downtown it dilute the entire definition of the statute to a compounded subjectivity of an officer? And that's the danger why I'm here. They get to say whatever they want at night, downtown, in every turn, in every on-ramp that they'll never pull over for anything else. And so his tire touches the center line, then what? So we get to argue over the size of the pothole. That's what my omnibus hearings will be forever. We're going to argue that I saw a pothole. No, you didn't see a pothole. Actually, I did. Actually, my car doesn't run very well. That car was parked too close and the pedestrians are here. And so this practical is, well, if you're successful and safely turning right, as the Utah court and several of the other federal district courts say, where is the zone of danger? Where does law enforcement get to say, you know what, if you're drifting and you make a turn or, you know, there's weather and there's wind and there's other things, but there's no safety issues whatsoever. And you do it as safely and practicably as you can as a driver. Then what? Then it's okay. And in fact, it's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment because law enforcement actually has to take into all the facts and circumstances. As actually noted right away by the Court of Appeals in Morris, they identified that there were no bikes and pedestrians. The irony here is we have the bikes and pedestrians. I'm not sure if they're riding bike or a scooter, but you can see them with their lights on. So thank you. I'm done.
Thank you, Council.